Our next guest on Downtown has had a long career in television shows, of course, like MASH, Providence. The author of a wonderful memoir entitled Just Call Me Mike. It talks about not only his acting career, but his decades-long work as an activist. He's been a great friend of the show through the years, and we're pleased to be able to welcome Mike Farrell back to Downtown. Mike, good afternoon.
Nice to talk to you again, Rich.
I want to get right to what's going on in America and cut to the chase here, because these are, some troubled times, to say the least, in our country. Mike, how did we get to this place where we're so polarized and into our own little tribes?
Well, I think there's been a lot of distance between the people of the country and the people who are in positions of power in the country. And that distance has been allowed to, I think, metastasize to the degree that there's a lot of anger and upset and lost hope and expectations that have left people vulnerable to someone who can play on their most base emotions and take advantage of their anger and their frustration with, some kind of wild promises. Only I can fix this. I'll fix this. Just listen to me. Don't listen to them. That sort of thing. And I think too many people have fallen prey to that. But I think it's something that will be remedied eventually if we care enough to get involved in the issues that are facing us and express ourselves at the ballot box and by writing to our members of Congress and the U.S. Senate. But it really involves people caring enough about their country and about what their country means, as well as how its policies affect them personally. And that's sometimes a tough thing for people to get a hold of.
What role has the media played in getting us to this place?
Unfortunately, the media, I think, has been significantly negative in that there's the old unfortunate media motto, if it bleeds, it leads, which leads to them featuring the most screaming siren, the most blood, the most ugliness, the most salacious, the most outrageous kind of things, rather than doing the sort of analysis they used to do. We lost, and during the Reagan years, we lost the idea of equal time, which would mean that if there's an issue that could be arguably debated, there used to be a requirement on the public airwaves that people would hear both sides. When that was lost, the side with the most money usually is the one that people hear, and that is not always in the best interests of the population.
What do you think of the biggest obstacles to us finding common ground once again?
Boy, hard work. Thomas Jefferson said that the real strength of this nation was in an involved and informed electorate. People lack basic information, and they lack a willingness to get involved. Once they allow themselves to get involved, I think the information is available, but they have to be careful about where they look and to be sure to double check and triple check and balance, make sure that they get balanced views, and then make a decision. But people who are unwilling to do that, people who are just angry and want somebody else to fix it for them, aren't helping. So it seems to me, again, I go back to the basic premise. If you care about the country, if you care about the fundamental premises of the country, then it seems to me that our path forward is pretty clear. But if you care only about your own situation, and you are therefore threatened by people of different races or people from different parts of the world that want to come into our country or people who you think are stealing your jobs or, if you allow yourself to be manipulated, I guess I should say, by the forces out there that want to tell you that it's easy, it's simple, we simply go back to the 1950s and forget about the fact that people of color were subjugated and women were subjugated and that there was no real equality of opportunity for people.
We're talking with Mike Farrell here on Downtown. And as you know, Mike, I teach young people. I teach government, and it becomes a bigger challenge every year to convince them that, first of all, the system can work, but that it works by them getting involved and not letting the ugliness and the distractions keep them away from caring about what happens in Washington and in their home state.
Well, bless you for that, because that's exactly what's needed, is them caring enough and really paying attention. You know, there, we've got people blaring out all over the airwaves all kinds of stuff on both sides or all sides, some of the most crazy stuff you could imagine. But I think if you put it to the test of truth and reality, rather than allowing somebody to say to you that's fake news or you shouldn't believe that, trust me, don't trust them, there's a price to pay for that.
There are a couple of schools of thought here. One is that, we've gotten down in the dirt, and that's the only way to win is to fight fire with fire. Or do you think it's best for us to always try to maintain the high ground in these conversations?
That's my own thought, is that we have to really be scrupulous about sticking to our principles. And that's sometimes not an easy thing to do when the other side is being really ugly and trotting out just horrific lies and abusing the weapons they have through the media. But I think fundamentally, let me just make a suggestion, if you will. If you look today at the Senate race in Texas, there's a young man by the name of Beto. Beto O'Rourke, I think it is, but Irish last name. And I've been really impressed with the fact that he steps up and speaks his truth and isn't worried about speaking to things that aren't currently de rigueur in Texas politics. And I think, you know, somebody that has the courage to do that, instead of getting down and sliming your opponent and trying to say, she or he is unworthy, untrustworthy, a crook, a thief, a villain, a bad person. Instead of that, just saying the truth as best you can articulate it, that seems to me to be the way to win the trust of people. And I don't mean to suggest necessarily that Beto is going to win his race, but for me, it's been a pleasure to watch him articulate the reasons why he believes what he does and why he thinks it's best for his state and his country, rather than what a bad guy his opponent is.
Mike, you've been working for many years to end the death penalty in California and around the nation as well. The Pope has come out and expressed his thoughts. Does that, in the big picture, will that do anything to help that cause?
Well, one hopes, you know, the Catholics who want to believe in the Pope's infallibility are going to have to take a look at what he says. I think there is difficulty on the parts of people who have long held the belief that the death penalty is sometimes necessary or appropriate. But I think, you know, the Pope is here we go again. There are different views in the Catholic Church even about this Pope. I happen to think he's a demonstrably sensitive, thoughtful, dedicated, religious man, and that to me counts for a lot. And his willingness to wash the feet of sinners, if you will, and deal with the needs of refugees and get down and dirty, but it down and dirty in the sense of really working down with the lower classes, demonstrates to me somebody who's really a caring person who follows in the footsteps of Jesus, if you happen to believe in the Catholic version of Christianity. I think he will make a difference ultimately if he isn't unseated by forces in the Catholic Church that are very orthodox and very conservative and are frightened or even angered by some of the policies that he's put forward. But, you know, we're seeing progress being made, Rich. The state of Washington, the Supreme Court just recently ruled that the death penalty there does not meet constitutional standards. And it did so on a basis that we have argued for many years is across the country, racial imbalance and speculative, the prosecution of people based on kind of thoughtless, but usually resulting in bad decisions on the parts of prosecutors because they're trying to get a quick conviction of somebody rather than really investigating a case to the to be definitely sure that they have found the rightful perpetrator. And even then, being unwilling to realize that we are wasting a lot of money on a death penalty when you could save money by keeping people in prison for the rest of their natural lives if they did the crime that you want to punish them for.
We're talking with Mike Farrell on Downtown. Mike, since we spoke with you last, you've lost a couple of members of the MASH family. Could you talk a little bit about what he was like as a person and what it was like working with the talented David Ogden Stiers?
I could indeed. David was a wonderful man, and he and I were very close. He came to the show late, as people who watch MASH know, when old ferret face Larry Linville, Frank Burns' character, left the show. They decided, the producers, to their credit, decided they wanted to bring in somebody who was a not just a buffoon like the Frank Burns character turned out to be, but not only was he a smart and thoughtful and well-trained, but a very good surgeon, unlike the Frank Burns character, and be a match for Hawkeye and BJ. And they selected David, who had done a lot of work in the business. And he was just delicious. He was just a wonderful guy who played this role to the T's. And he became a close friend of all of us, a member of the family. And David, I think, was the one member of the cast who was, once the show was over, was kind of reluctant to trade, if you will, on being Major Winchester. Didn't want to be stuck in that mold because that was a character that was very apart from his personal personality. But he was just I think the best trained and certainly one of the finest actors I've ever worked with, and a really extraordinary man. But when I say best trained, I mean from the point of view of those of us in the cast. David was schooled and had paid attention and had done his work classically, unlike a lot of actors, myself included, who came up through kind of catch-as-catch-can process where you get a job and you learn on the job and you hope for another job and study with one person and get an idea about a style, and then you study with somebody else and learn another one, and then you become a kind of a mutt or a mongrel. But David was just a prince of a guy, and he had a very tough break, cancer that he tried to be very quiet about. And we talked many times during the process of his attending to deal with this disease. And finally, he said, the doctors have said it's hopeless. So he went out with style, if you will. And the other man we lost a little while before that was one of my closest friends in the cast was Bill Christopher, Father Mulcahy, who also passed away from cancer a couple of years ago now, but a great loss to all of us. Bill was one of the sweetest human beings that ever walked the earth. So we lost Harry some time back, and I don't know if you're familiar with
Thad Mumford, right?
Thad Mumford. I was just going to say we just lost Thad Mumford, one of our writers of the last few seasons of the show, and a comic genius, and just a brilliant, wonderful guy who struggled in the business initially because he was an African American, and our business, like many other businesses, were kind of reluctant to be open to people of other races for a long period of time. But finally, the business wised up and began to open up to women and members of minority groups and other people who hadn't normally been thought of, and we were all the richer for it.
We had Mark Freeman from The Hollywood Reporter on with us. He's been on a number of times. He did a wonderful oral history with all of you from MASH. Do you ever get tired of talking about those days?
You know, I don't. I think Mark did a wonderful article about the show, and he and I put him in touch. He contacted me, and I put him in touch with a number of members of the cast that he hadn't been able to reach. I suppose, you know, I guess gave the example of David Stiers. I think other than David, everybody, I mean, we've all gone on and done other things and are happy to have had careers beyond MASH, but I don't think other than David, anybody wants to just sort of put it behind them. I think we're all so proud of what we did with that show and the wonderful relationships we developed both with the company and the people around us, the production staff and the writers and all of those folks. It really was, you know, there's sort of a cliche that says, well, you know, a television show, they become a family. But I know of television shows where people who work together hated each other. So it's not always the kind of a happy family that ours was. We still get together. Dan Wilcox, who was Thad's writing partner, has put together a memorial evening for Thad that's just coming up this end of this week, that we'll all be attending and swapping stories and remembering and wishing that things were different than they are.
Well, Mike, it's always a treat for us to get to talk about MASH with you, but also to get your thoughts, as always, very wonderful thoughts about how to heal the divisions in this country and get us on the right path. As always, we appreciate you making time for us.
Well, it's a pleasure, Rich, I'm sorry. And let me just say that for motivation, the people who are listening really need to think about the catastrophic climate changes that are upon us, and that one of the things that is being, that we and our, not only our children, but our children's children are going to suffer for, is the unwillingness of people in this country and too many people in other parts of the world to not recognize the danger that looms before us and really get serious about doing something about it.
Well said, Mike. Thank you, as always. Great to talk with you again. We wish you good health, and we'll talk with you again down the road.
Terrific. Thanks very much.
That's Mike Farrell with us here on